This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is More Talk Radio. Cecil Prescott talks with Rachel Lankford and Mike Rosen from Stand for Children, Portland, about public education in Oregon and the economic crisis.
KBOO is proud to host A Conversation with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, on Saturday, April 11th at the Baghdad Theater. This event is a benefit for KBOO Community Radio. KBOO's own Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza, hosts of Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, will interview Amy on stage. She will talk about her book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, and her experiences as an award-winning journalist. That's A Conversation with Amy Goodman benefit for KBOO on April 11th at noon at the Baghdad Theater in Southeast Portland. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm or by phone at 503-231-8032. KBOO has two open board seats and would like to conduct interviews with interested candidates. Those with skills in finance, nonprofit operations, and strategic planning are particularly encouraged to apply. Please call 503-516-3882 and leave a brief message with a phone number or email address at which you may be contacted. The deadline for applications is Monday, April 13th. Interviews will be conducted during the April 20th board meeting, which begins at 6 p.m.
Good morning.
As our economy faces its most severe crisis in decades, citizens and legislators are struggling to balance fiscal limitations and social needs. Education, often thought as the foundation of our healthy society, is not exempt from this tension. Today, on More Talk Radio, we will discuss the challenges we face in Oregon as we seek to fulfill our social obligation to provide a good education for our children and ensure fiscal stability. Joining Celeste and I today are Rachel Lankford, Portland Director of Stand for Children, and Mike Rosen, a parent volunteer for the organization. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Perhaps we can begin by talking about Stand for Children. Could you tell us the nature of the organization, its history, and its goals?
in 2 minutes or less.
Well, we're a grassroots, citizen-led organization, and our primary mission is to give parents like Mike in the city and educators, grandparents, concerned community members, the tools they need to be successful advocates on behalf of kids in public schools. And so we work on targeting elections where we're electing public officials who will prioritize kids in public schools, as well as fighting for ballot measures, for or against ballot measures that will either support or be a barrier to excellent public schools and services for children. Anything you'd add to that, Mike?
No, I would just say that a couple of things that the emphasis really is on empowering parents all across the economic and social spectrum in terms of training them to advocate for themselves. So it's got a really community-based grassroots nature. And then also it does a really good job of planning. We have a 10-year plan to bring Oregon schools into the top 10 nationally.
In terms of doing a grassroots outreach to communities and empowering people, What type of outreach do you do for to also include a lot of our immigrant, refugee, minority, low-income people? Because I heard you mention trying to get all parents in, and I'm sure that piqued some folks' ears.
Absolutely, and there are inherent challenges there into involving all parents, and the model that we use to organize is fairly intensive. We get parents involved and really give them the tools that they need. It involves a lot of training and support. Our staff provides an incredible amount of training and support to the volunteers we bring into the organization, and you know, where you're trying to organize in communities where you've got parents working multiple jobs, it's just more challenging. I feel like we're beginning to make inroads there with successful partnerships with organizations who are primarily serving communities of color, organizations like the Black Parent Initiative, working to get black parents in our community really engaged in their children's education, starting to work with the Urban League and Community Education Partners, which is a coalition of organizations that's primary focus is increasing the achievement of all students. By effective coalition building, we are able to tap into those communities and work together on issues that benefit all kids, where we may not be as successful as organizing in those communities as those particular organizations are. With those partnerships, we can pretty successfully work together, and we're really making some strides in that direction.
Mike, you are a parent.
Yeah.
And how did you become involved with this organization?
Well, starting back, I think, in somewhere around 2000, 2001, 2002, maybe it was 2003. But anyway, ballot measure 28 with a state under Kitzhaber was facing drastic cuts. We were in the middle we're about in the middle of the biennium. And we worked really hard to tap into reserves and even raise the state income tax so that we wouldn't close schools. And that vote failed. It was really close. And there were a lot of depressed parents after that. And we knew there wasn't a solution at the state level. And then we had a local initiative, Help Out Public Education, which passed the Multnomah County income tax, which sort of gave us a bridge for the next few years till the legislature could work it out, which didn't happen. But in any event, Stand for Children worked really actively. I'm pretty sure they were part of the Measure 28 coalition, but they worked really hard on the Multnomah County initiative. They just passed the children's levy in Portland. And what happened is after we passed the iTax, there were a lot of parents that it was sort of a boom and bust thing. Parents would get involved when there was really a crisis, but we didn't have any sustained groups. PTA very much wasn't very political in terms of activism, and they can't be to some extent because of their status. So sort of Stand filled the gap. It allowed the parents to come together on a regular basis and develop a concerted, consistent strategy that we could implement over time, which is essentially what we're doing.
We're speaking this morning with representatives from Stand for Children. Our guests this morning are Rachel Lanford. And Mike Rosen, and our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We ask that you hold your calls for our guests for a little while as we establish some more understanding of their work. We'll be pleased to take your calls in a few minutes.
Right. One of the things that I think is really important to hear is how you are envisioning addressing both where we're standing with the budget shortfall and where you would like to go with a new budget. And I know there are a lot of other points. I mean, one of the things that we do want to address is what are some of the visions of a strong school? Because we talked about that, or briefly talk on community choice in terms of school and schools in the area. But with regard just to the budget, what would you say would be some good advice for parents in terms of engaging with how to address the shortfall?
Well, I think we sort of averted one crisis. On President's Day, Stand for Children and other groups brought 5,000 parents down to Salem. to show that this was a priority, that education was a priority. But a few days after that, we were looking at another $100 million cut in the current fiscal year for schools. And then Stand for Children effectively mobilized 8,000 petitioners and was able to cut that $100 million cut essentially in half. Now what we're looking at is exactly what you're saying. What's the budget going to look like for the next 2 years? April 15th, roughly, we're going to get something from the legislature. And it looks like it's going to be a budget that shows if we did not raise any revenues and if we have something like a $3 billion shortfall in revenues, what the budget would look like. So people understand what a complete cut budget would look like. That's going to get shopped around the state in terms of community sessions so people can give feedback.
Of the Ways and Means Committee.
Right.
Traveling around the state.
So the first point is people need to know what that budget is and let legislators know what the impacts are. So organize in their communities to be present. But the other thing that Stand for Children's doing that I think is pretty critical is developing house parties, workshops. We're going to have one, for example, on April 18th at the Kennedy School where we're going to be talking about what options exist. We're going to be talking with people that are really smart on taxation issues like Steve Novick to advise us where we might have some low-hanging fruit to raise revenue. We're going to have Diane Rosenbaum, Senator Diane Rosenbaum, who's on the Revenue Committee, and Representative Jules Copel Bailey to talk to us about what some of the options we have are, how to effectively work with the legislator so we can promote what's most important to us, and then also to help us understand what some of the barriers are that they're facing so we can provide the best support possible. So it really is about being active now and ready to testify at hearings, to talk to your legislators when they're in their community, and to get people to join Stand and be ready to write letters to the editor, send out emails to friends, to be engaged, because we have about a six-week window, and this is going to make a difference.
And can I get that date again really quickly before you go on, Rachel?
Of the workshop? Yeah,
yes.
It's at the Kennedy School. It's the morning of April 18th. It's a Saturday morning, and it'll be from 10 to noon.
In the community room.
Yeah.
Great. And we will repeat that, too. But you were about to say, Rachel?
Yeah, I'm just going to underscore one thing that Mike said about one thing that parents can do now and continually through the rest of the session is to help their legislators understand really what it looks like now in their children's schools, to paint a very vivid picture, because we talk about schools a lot and we, I think, assume that our legislators understand the state of our schools, and that's not necessarily so. And one of the most effective things that parent advocates can do, maybe they get a little nervous thinking about talking to the legislators, but all they have to do is tell their story and say, paint a picture of what it looks like with 35, you know, sixth graders in a class and not enough textbooks to go around and holding math group in the stairwell and things like that, so that they understand, here's what it looks like now. Imagine what it's going to look like if we're $1 billion short on the state budget for schools. That's drastic. And one more point, we have the opportunity to raise revenue in this legislative session because we have a pro-schools majority. We have a majority in the House and in the Senate that would allow them to actually do some of the things that we'll be discussing on the 18th. And that is something that Stand has worked very hard on. We worked to get a simple majority in the House back in 2006 so that we could actually begin to reinvest in schools. And then this last election cycle, we got involved in elections again, trying to get that supermajority, that three-fifths majority that we would actually need to stabilize our revenue system so that we can get off this roller coaster and get off this boom and bust cycle that we've been on for decades. And we have this critical opportunity now, and we really have to seize it.
Yeah, I would just add to that. Rachel's absolutely right. When I talk to parents, one of the things that's most disconcerting is they talk about, oh, here we are again facing cuts. But step by step, we've built up support in terms of having the right majority that we need in the legislature. So this is the time to activate them and to ask them to step up and be courageous. And so for all the complainers and worriers out there that it's the same as it always has been, it's not. We have a real opportunity, even in these tough economic times, to move the ball forward.
You mentioned you have worked for many years to get a pro-education majority in the House and in the Senate. Now that we have, we also discover that we're in the midst of a fiscal meltdown. What are some of the challenges you face as an organization in terms of advocating for sound education policy and funding and the crisis that we face, economic crisis we face in terms of balancing different priorities?
Yes, like health care versus education, for example.
Absolutely. And our members care deeply about health care as well. So it's in our minds not an either or, but a both and the only way we get to the both and is if we raise revenue and grow the pie that's available for our critical services that the state is supposed to be providing. So that's, again, why we focus on, when we go into stabilizing funding, we focus on raising revenue, which floats all the boats.
Right. Now, one of the things that's really interesting, too, and I wonder if this is an approach you take, do you show how good education helps impact health and keep health health issues lower on our horizon? In other words, kids who get a good education, are well fed when they come to school, can have less health problems. Because Jonah did show that there is a relationship between education and our economic stability here in the state by making sure you have kids who are educated to be part of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Do you look for those connections and promote that kind of information as well?
Absolutely. When we look at the what services the state supports, it's public education, public safety, and human services, and there's links between all of those. And public education is one of the best preventative things that we as a society can do. So we can invest now or we can pay later, and that's very clear, and there's plenty of sound economic arguments about the amount of money we put into public education now, and if we don't do it, what we end up paying down the road when we put juveniles in jail and have to deal with them in the health and human services and in the public safety realm.
I think one of the statistics Jonah used was 80% of those incarcerated in Oregon's prisons did not graduate from high school.
Right.
And we're spending something like $23,000 a year per person to keep them there. And I think we're really at a tipping point. If you look at popular culture, yesterday's Parade magazine had the cover story was about the fact that we have 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prison population.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs a lot of money to do that. And education is a real breakthrough in terms of getting people out of that cycle.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Rachel Langford, who is the Portland Director of Stand for Children, and Mike Rosen, who's a parent volunteer. Please join the conversation by dialing 503-231-8187 here at KBOO Portland. And you can be part of our conversation here. So, again, the phone number 503-231-8187 and join in the conversation.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was in terms of education as a need for all communities and the need to make sure we have good education for all of our children. In a recent speech Jonah Edelman gave to the City Club of Portland, he outlined a philosophy, some possible solutions in terms of solving some problems. I imagine one thing that you often encounter with people who challenge you is that, well, we need to do some reforms in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
What are some things that Stand for Children advocate for in terms of school reform, in terms for improving education?
Well, and you're speaking of Jonah Edelman, who's our executive director, and what he outlined in his City Club speech are things that we've become increasingly focused on as an organization, and specifically what we know matters most as far as how students achieve is the quality, number one, the quality of the teacher in the classroom.
And the principal.
And then number two, the quality of the administrator, of the principal.
Mm-hmm.
Educator quality is more important than anything else. So we've focused for a long time on more money. We need to get more money into this system because it's inadequately funded. That's true, and that's going to be true for a while, given the way that our tax system is
our tax
structured.
Base here
exactly,
in Oregon. Yes.
Exactly. So we're not going to be out of this pickle anytime soon. We're working to do some long-term stabilization now, but we'll be dealing with this. So we've got to target the scarce dollars that we have in the most effective ways, and one of the most effective things we can do is to make sure we've got the best quality teaching force. And we've got great teachers here in Portland, and we've got great teachers and great principals all over the state of Oregon, but we can do much more to better prepare them and support them when they get into their careers. And there are some specific things that we've done. Back in one of the things we were proudest of in the 2007 session was we passed the new educator mentor program. And we essentially got seed money for that program so that 1,000 new teachers and principals across the state could get quality mentorship in their first 2 years of their career. And we would like to see that expanded so that all first and second year teachers and principals get that same kind of rigorous support in those critical first years of their career, because research shows that children who have a quality teacher, who have a very effective teacher for 3 years in a row, they can go from the 50th percentile to the 90th percentile on their way to success and to graduation. And if you take a student at the 50th percentile and they have, excuse me, an ineffective teacher for 3 years in a row, then they drop down to the 37th.
About the 30th, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then much more likely to struggle and drop out. And so this is focusing on getting our new teachers mentored into even looking at colleges of education, how are they preparing our teachers, are things that we can be doing now.
Yeah, and I think this is just really emphasizes the sort of the long-term thinking that Stand for Children does. If you just look at the money for this, I think the mentor program in its first 2 years was $5 million.
Right.
The cost per year of high teacher turnover in the state is $45 million. And
so we can do the math.
Right. Yeah. And to expand the mentorship program to every teacher, new teacher in the state, would be $15 million. So if you had a complete program even, it would be one-third the cost of what it costs the state just in turnover. The one quick thing I'd say about this, we went back to the legislature recently. Another example of what STAND does is they organized meetings for parents and advocates with swing Republicans.
Mm.
Basically what happened is right after the rally, we met with Democrats in leadership roles in the legislature. Senator Margaret Carter said, you know what you could do to help us? Why don't you go talk to our Republican friends, because we're going to need them. And so that's what we did a couple of weeks ago. To a person, even the most conservative Republican acknowledged the mentorship program that STAND has advocated for and their support of it, which was great. And that's the kind of stuff that we're advocating for.
Well, when you speak of teacher quality, I hear it couched, though, in more than just terms of new teachers. The issue is, what if you have a teacher who is a little weak in performance area, who is not new? Isn't this extended, maybe in a different category, but isn't this kind of mentorship or assistance extended to weaker teachers who have been around a while?
Well, the program that we advocated for is specifically for first and
okay,
second
so just
year.
For.
Mm-hmm. Teachers, not saying that there aren't more supports needed for teachers who are struggling mid-career or end of career. And I think where we can do a lot better in this city and in this state is identifying appropriately with good evaluation tools the teachers that do need support and getting them the support they need. And that's not something that we're doing well. I mean, in this city alone, last school year we had, I think, just about 14 teachers on plans of assistance throughout the entire district. There's over 3,000 teachers in this district. Like I said, Portland's full of high quality teachers, but still, you wonder: are we supporting the teachers who need the most support? That's a very, very low percentage, and so that comes down not just on the teacher, but on the administrators as well. Are they getting the support they need from the district to be really solid evaluators of the educators in their building? And do they have the tools that they need to do their job in that regard? And we can do more there. There's lots of opportunities to do more.
We're speaking this morning with representatives from Stand for Children, Rachel Langford and Mike Rosen. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. One of the major points in terms of our education we discuss are teachers. Another important aspect are the administrators and the principals. What are some of your thoughts and proposals for principals and the administrators of schools?
Well, with this program, we think they also need support in their early career. I mean, we all need support in our early careers, and we overall just don't do a good job with educators in that regard. And then I would say we don't have as well defined a program for exactly what needs to happen with an administrator. But we do know, and this is just from anecdotally talking to administrators across the district and across the state, that they don't get necessarily adequate support from their school district to do everything that their incredibly demanding job requires.
Or maybe even that they're gifted and talented to do. Is that part of what Jonah was referring to as autonomy with regard to schools as well?
Right. So being able to meet the needs of the students in their building, if you look at just Portland Public Schools alone, what a diverse portfolio of schools that we have here serving many different types of children. And having principals be able to get the staff that they want in their building who's committed to their vision and their mission to serve their particular student body, and empowering them to really meet the needs of those kids. And then, you know, principals have just an incredible workload. They're building managers. They're also instructional leaders. So how can we help support them? And if you look at other school districts, and this, again, requires more money, but move some of those sort of building management tasks off their plate so they can really focus on what matters most, instructional leadership. That's important.
Yeah, I wanted to just quickly emphasize that. I think one of the things that Carol Smith has done a good job of is try to provide support within buildings for principals so that they have a building manager component and they have a personnel manager component. That's probably one of the things we're going to see less of with the cuts, but each building is like a little city, mm-hmm. and there isn't enough time to manage the people or work with the people and the function of the building, and you need to have those kind of supports.
Yes. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the city, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and in the Willamette Valley, it's 100.7. We're speaking with Rachel Langford, who is the Portland Director of Stand for Children, Mike Rosen, parent and volunteer, and we'll be talking to you if you dial 503-231-8187. We're going to go to our first caller. Thank you, Jenny, for holding and being patient. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. My mother was a sixth grade math teacher in Colorado for 30 years, and I really appreciate what this group is doing, and I appreciate this constructive approach to dealing with our challenges in our school. She was teaching through the 90s, and I think that's when we started to see more cuts and more challenges. And a lot of times the way that parents responded to that was through frustration and blame, and, you know, because a lot of parents didn't understand the structures and the system of the school. And so she got a lot of problems from parents, which I thought was so sad because she had you know, parents and teachers can really work together and be effective like you guys are doing. So thank you for being constructive and trying to help teachers and not make them the
scapegoats. Yeah.
The other question that I have is she taught math, and she really went out of her way to teach a different, more innovative, and more inclusive style of math that not just the WIS kids would get. And she participated in studies at the University of Colorado, and, you know, she definitely went out of her way to do it. But she seems, you know, one of her big things now that she looks at the state of our schools is she says that, you know, what is really, really critical, and I think that this mentorship program is great, is curriculum, is, you know, designing curriculum that works for more children and that is less narrow, because that seemed to really be the secret to her success. So I'm just wondering, you know, what you guys do on that level, if that's something that you have any sway over, and, you know, maybe that the just the, you know, issues around curriculum itself. So I'll take my answer off the air, but thank you for all your work.
Thank you, Jenny.
Bye.
Well, thank you, Jenny, very much. And we are not at Stanford Children curriculum experts, so we've not weighed in on particular curriculum decisions that have been made in our local districts. But one thing that we do advocate for, and now that I say that, I realize that's not true. In Eugene, they really were fighting. We have a chapter in Eugene, and they were really working hard with their district to not have a narrow curriculum imposed on the district that would really limit teacher creativity. And so Jenny mentioned innovation, and we know that's key for really serving our students, that teachers and administrators need to be able to innovate to reach the children in their buildings. If you have a narrow curriculum that's very narrowly prescribed, as in, and these exist, you know, you teach this between, you know, 9:12 and 9:18, and then you transition to the next piece, not allowing for children to be where they are, and having teachers feel so constrained by this very scripted curricula that they, you know, if they feel that they're really engaging, and we've heard anecdotes, you know, I felt like I was really engaging my students, but I worried that I would get in trouble if I stayed with them on this particular lesson and didn't transition, you know, to the math lesson at 10:25. And that's not the kind, I mean, when we talk about autonomy, we need teachers to be able to understand their students and to teach to those kids.
And administrators to stand up to the district so that the teachers have that freedom.
Absolutely, and for the district to realize that adopting narrow curricula like that isn't in the best interest of all kids.
Just one thing I would add that's also one of the benefits of Stanford Children, in terms of the spectrum of people that it has supporting it or volunteering, we do have a lot of current retired teachers and administrators, and I think there's been a really strong push in the last couple of years, and I think Jonah highlighted this in his City Club speech in terms of bringing schools into the 21st century, is just changing the model of the way we educate our educators and treating them more like professionals that have to learn, continue to learn throughout their career, and give them opportunities, you know, connecting teachers to their professors in their colleges, having those professors interact more in the classroom using the medical school model. And I think those are some really interesting ideas, because it does seem like there are always lots of opportunities. Things are changing just in terms of technology, and it's not a static profession.
In terms of the medical school model, for people who are listening and may not know, we're talking about educators who are currently involved in their profession as opposed to removed as many as 10, 15, 20 years.
Right.
One of the things that many people who focus on education look at are the roles of that teachers and particularly unions play. Sometimes they are thought of as a scapegoat. How does your organization work with teachers' unions? Are they involved in the conversation? Are there tensions? Are there ways in which you find new ways of cooperating in the 21st century?
Well, we've absolutely partnered with our local teachers' unions and the statewide teachers' unions on many different issues over the years, particularly, you know, when we're working to stabilize funding. We're all at that table working really hard together. And then, you know, when it comes to talking about issues of reform and issues of teacher quality, those can be more challenging areas to speak with a teachers union about. But I think we're always, what we know is that we have the same goals. We know that teachers got into the profession to educate our kids. We are an organization made up of educators and parents and concerned community members who who want to see the best possible outcomes for kids. So there's always opportunities for us to meet there and to work from there. And one thing that we find is just as we engage with teachers who are on the ground in the field, they're very willing to talk about innovation. They understand what's working and what's not working. And that's where we get our sort of impetus to want to work on these things is our members and the teachers and principals that we meet in our community schools and hearing directly from them what the challenges are, what's working really well, and going from there.
I wanted to add to that because I think this is a particularly difficult and challenging issue for us. I mean, for parents particularly, because we bond so closely with teachers. And as we look at the issues, not just of funding, but of improving quality in the classroom, we definitely cross into issues that are contract regulated, so to speak. And it's hard to... you can't avoid contract issues if you're talking about teacher and principal quality. And so how do you have that dialogue? Rachel's talked about it. You know, you keep talking about what the common good is. But I do think that as we start to look at some of these issues, we're going to have to figure out a way to communicate. It's going to be tough to communicate as constructively as possible. And I think there's a pressure at the federal level in terms of some of Obama's initiatives. But I think there are really good things happening, like the Chalkboard Project is doing a study in local schools on pay for performance or teacher
incentives.
Yeah, teacher incentives. And the way they're starting there, I think there are three places, Sherwood, Tualatin, and a third place, where they're actually allowing the teachers to develop a program that works for their community. It's also interesting, and I think Jonah mentioned this in his speech as well, there are really hardcore union teachers in Colorado, and one of the significant changes they made in curriculum at a single school, which was, I guess, sort of the epicenter of union activism, they decided to step outside their contract so that they could implement what they wanted to implement. So I think it's really important for us to acknowledge that these are going to be challenging issues. The unions play a really strong role. Sometimes it can get polarized, but the thing is what Rachel says, it's the interests of being quality educators and educating our children brings us more together than divides us.
Right. And the fact that sometimes teachers as their peers make your best advocates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because if I remember listening to Jonah's speech, the school in Colorado, what they did is that the teachers who were part of that union went to their colleagues and basically either advocated for the changes or advocated for them to consider other employment, you know. And when you have your peers giving you honest evaluation like that, it does tend to either sway you one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to stay and be part of this and be on board, or yes, maybe I do need to leave.
Right.
Yeah.
We're speaking this morning with representatives for Stand for Children, Rachel Langford and Mike Rosen. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We're speaking about education this morning. We'll go to our next caller who's been waiting. Good morning, caller.
Yes, hello. I'd like to see a campaign to bring back the children that dropped out of middle school and high school because of abuses and that and bullying, and a special place for them where they can go and finish at least high school. I'm a low income grandmother of a couple of biracial children with disabilities. And they're one of some of these people. They're unfortunately they're in their late teens now and early 20s, and I guess they're just collateral of this capitalistic country that throw away people that they don't care about, and they don't care if they go in the military or into jail because there's no help and support. I want them brought back into the school, into the community, and a place where they can at least finish their high school education.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, Carla.
You raised some important issues, and I note that one bill that the legislature is considering, or one part of the legislature has passed, is an anti-bullying proposal. But to speak to the other things that the caller raised, would you respond?
Well, and Stanford Children signed on to that legislation for anti-bullying as well. It's incredibly important. As far as bringing kids back into the system who've already separated, I am unaware of current efforts there, and that's not something that we as an organization have been specifically looking at, but we are involved with Mayor Adams and County Commissioner or County Chair Ted Wheeler's efforts to target kids in those late middle school years who are at risk of dropping out,
mm-hmm.
and to really bring all community resources to bear upon those children so that we don't lose them. And there are a host of strategies being looked at there. We're still in the planning phases. But I would say between the Portland Schools Foundation and their ninth grade counts program, which is also about that critical eighth to ninth
yes.
grade transition, and making sure that we not only identify these students but also give them the whole host of supports that they will need to move on, and not just move on and be successful in ninth grade, but to progress on and graduate and connect with either college or meaningful work beyond their graduation. And I mean, that's something that's critically important to this organization and to our members.
We do have another caller on board. We'll go to our caller. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. I'm the husband of a retired special education teacher, and the idea of performance pay is bothersome to me because it tends to forget about the fact that there are students that are underperforming because of a medical condition. And so... Mm-hmm. How do they propose to address schools with a disproportionate number of students who are identified as special education students? It seems to me that the way the system's set up now, it punishes schools for underperformance, but it doesn't address the fundamental issue of students with special needs.
You know, that's a good question. I do want to kind of draw a little bit out as we turn this over to Rachel and to Mike. Are you saying that one of the things that your partner experienced was not having those same kind of benchmarks applied to classes with special needs children? In other words, understanding where they are and then accounting for them with benchmarks that are specific to that environment?
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly the point. And that schools are punished if under No Child Left Behind, especially, and it seems that President Obama is going the same direction with rewarding teachers for the performance of the students. What about special education teachers? What about if you have a class of TMR kids, you know, that
TMR.
Are trainable mentally retarded?
Okay.
I mean, how do you, you know, is it going to be a situation where the most talented teachers are going to be forced by economic conditions to go out of that profession or out of that specialty?
Well, thank you for your question.
Sure.
Tom, you raise a great question, and it just shows how flawed the current No Child Left Behind program is, in that if you think of a business or a company, what company would cut off resources and punish a branch that was struggling or failing?
Or dealing with a slightly different demographic.
Exactly. No, they would bring all their resources to the table for that branch and help them succeed. And that's what we would like to see. That's a shift that we would like to see, and we think there's opportunities on the national level with the Obama administration. And I think the tricky thing when you talk about pay for performance is the way we do it currently with No Child Left Behind, which are these snapshot tests that basically measure how kids are doing on a particular moment, on a particular day, and we're not measuring growth. We're not looking at the success of a teacher. Did they take a student who was, you know, maybe a fourth grader but at a first grade reading level, but maybe that teacher brought that student up to a third grade reading level in a year? That's tremendous, but they didn't get up to quote-unquote standard. Therefore, they're failing.
Right.
And so we need to see a shift in how we test our students so that if you're going to reward teachers, you're really looking at the breadth and depth of what they're doing with students, not just narrowly testing a couple of subjects on a particular day.
And I would just, this is Mike, I would just add to that. I mean, I think it's a really good point, and it's one of the things that's scary about this, all the different demographics, all the different special needs. On the other hand, I think the solution is just in that vein. We have to identify the populations that we're dealing with, and it's about accountability. You know, having that community set some reasonable performance standards that we can strive for and provide. And Rachel, you know, really hits it on the head with No Child Left Behind. It's about bringing resources to bear to help to promote success rather than punishing
or address real problems.
Yeah, and so I think it can be done. I will tell you that I don't think it's a quick fix solution, and I don't think it can be mandated from the top down. It has to be a solution that comes from the community of professionals that deserve to have their hard work acknowledged and to have career rewards as they continue in their profession.
You know, Tom, if you're still listening, I do want to encourage you and your spouse to be a part of Stand for Children if you're not already, because the kind of insight that you brought to just the air right now is the kinds of perspectives that are needed to help flesh out Stand for Children's ability to advocate for parents, teachers, children, and all of us. So thanks for your call.
One thing that we haven't mentioned is how to become involved with Stand for Children. Now, Stand for Children is a statewide organization with branches in different cities. Mm-hmm. How will we become a part of Stand for Children?
Well, there's several different things you can do. You can, if you just want to get on our website and check us out, that's a really easy thing to do. You can go to www.stand.org, and all of our different chapters are listed there. That's Portland is a chapter. We have 13 chapters across the state in different communities. And we're actually a national organization as well, so we are organized in Massachusetts and Tennessee and Washington. And
need to be in California.
Harder to spread right into California. It's such a big state.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And so that'll be farther down the road, but Colorado is next.
Uh-huh.
And so you can look at the work in all of our different states there. And through all those chapter pages, you can get a sense of what the chapter is working on. There's contact information for all of our volunteer leaders. This is really a volunteer-led organization. So
mm-hmm.
Across the city of Portland, we have 10 community and neighborhood-based teams. These are networks of people who are real the engine of this organization. They're the folks who, when it's time to get thousands of people on buses and go down to Salem, they're the ones that are filling those buses. And so the leaders of those teams, there are links that you can press to send them emails if you see, oh, I live in this neighborhood, I want to get involved with this team. If you don't see any teams in your community, then you can just email us and give us a call, because we're all the time sending our organizers out so that we can be in more communities across the city and across the state. And a great introductory thing to do, especially if you're interested in the budget and stabilizing revenue, is to come to this revenue forum that is on the 18th. It's going to be at the Kennedy School in the community room from 10 to noon. We'll be talking with a state representative, Jules Copel Bailey, and Senator Dianne Rosenbaum, who are both on the revenue committee, about revenue solutions. And you want to add something?
Yeah, I want to add, and one of my favorite tax experts in the world, Steve Novick, who's going to tell us what we can and can't do. And I would just challenge everyone, 2 hours, come down. I bet you'll get some ideas to generate millions of dollars for your community, because that's how Stand works.
Well, and I want to flag one other introductory event that's that same week. We have kind of a tax week theme, I guess, but on the 15th of April, we're going to have basically an introductory meeting to Stand. It's going to be less focused on revenue and a little more broadly focused on what is Stand for Children, what are our concerns as a community, and how can Stand meet them. It's a real 101 opportunity, and that's going to be on April 15th from 6:30 to 8 at Westminster Presbyterian Church, and you can call the organization or email me. That's R Langford, LANGFORD, at stan.org for more information on that.
We're almost out of time, and time was the one thing that we didn't really get to address with regard to some of the core problems in Oregon education system. We have, is it with the fourth or second shortest school year?
Second
shortest school year in the country. And there are different proposals on the table of as how to address this. But could you just briefly talk a little bit about how, if we're going to bring our education system into the 21st century, we might think of changing our calendar?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite and least favorite and most disturbing statistics. I mean, we do have the second shortest school year in the country, but I like to remind people exactly what that means. When you look at K-12, so we rank number 49th with 165 days. The average of 50 states is 177 days. So we're talking about having 2.5 weeks less. And in the top 10, it's 180 days, so 3 weeks less. I mean, it's really an embarrassment. In fact, I'm embarrassed by it when I go visit my friends back east. I mean, it's really it's amazing how much time our kids are out of school. Clearly, that costs money. We have to raise the base budget for schools so we can have kids in school. Jonah also, though, in his City Club speech, talked a lot about, you know, different models. There are problems. Even if we had 15 more days of school, there are other models in terms of year-round school that would work better in terms of retention. I mean, it's pretty well known that if you end school in June and start back up again in September, you spend September and October getting kids to remember what they forgot over the summer.
Or getting them back into the system of learning.
Yeah, just my kids, just getting them to wake up in the morning takes 2 months. So it's really, this gets back to the fact that it's not just more money, but it's how we spend the money we have, where we can bring schools into the 21st century and really get a bigger bang for our buck.
And make sure that our kids can compete on a global scale, which, I mean, the stats in how much our kids are learning in this country compared to other countries. I don't have them top of mind, but it's also disturbing.
Well, that's one of the reasons why we're failing globally to compete.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just abysmal when you look at some of the statistics, and Jonah's City Club speech was chock full of them. We're going to have less kids graduating from high school this generation, the previous generation. That's the first time in recorded history.
Less than 50%.
When you talk about the actual number, you look at things like professionals at a time when we have greater need for technical professionals. You know, when the baby boomers retire, we're training less, and I think we're last in the world in terms of the number of engineers that we're training, and we're low by, I mean, a really large majority.
That's a significant amount. Yeah.
And so there's just a lot of stuff that we need to look at, and it's going to take some time to turn around, but the statistics show a pattern of disinvestment in a critical area of public service.
We're going to take one last caller for our program today, and we'll go to our caller. Thank you for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, folks. It seems to me a lot that could be said for the public schools. We have, without a doubt, the most creative working class in the world, more Nobel Prizes than any of all the other countries combined, nearly. A tremendous amount of innovation and creation. Most of those people went to public schools, although to be sure, schools have to be improved. I want to ask you about the merit pay. It seems to me we see what merit pay did on Wall Street. It drove people wild to get more money. And it's not just a matter of aligning the incentives to the merit, the incentives, so you get the right kind of behavior. A lot of people have pointed out that what merit pay does is that it substitutes extrinsic motivation for intrinsic. People don't teach because they want to make a lot of money. They teach because they feel a vocation, because it's important, and because it's useful and a wonderful thing to do. And when you do merit pay, it seems to me it replaces that motivation but it also leads to competition amongst teachers, and it gives huge amount of power to the principals. And it replaces sort of a good school culture with a kind of top-down and competitive school culture. I think merit pay has really huge problems, and I wonder if you'd discuss those.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Just a couple of comments. I think that's a great question. I think sort of the premise logic is misguided. I mean, I don't think we should be talking about merit pay in terms of the way the Polson family has, you know, robbed from the poor to enrich themselves with, you know, millions and millions in golden parachutes. When companies fail, they're still highly rewarded. We're talking about creating performance-based incentives to keep people in careers and motivated. You know, and in the best, when the times are best in this country, civil servants, public people in public service like educators, the most that they can expect usually is a cost of living increase. They top out early in their career because they're so poorly paid relative to other professions with the same level of responsibility. And really what we're talking about is accountability, minor but significant forms of motivation to keep people learning in this career instead of bailing out. And, you know, I think it's not going to be the only thing that motivates them, clearly, but it's a very important factor.
Well, and another piece of that is having within the profession of teaching,
yes,
things that motivate teachers
and
to
stimulate.
Move forward and stimulate, because the way it is set up now, basically you are a teacher and you earn more pay based on how long you've been around and how much further education that you get, not necessarily related to what you actually, not related at all to what you're actually doing in your school and your classroom.
And how you demonstrate how well you love what you're doing.
And so giving teachers, as a lot of us have, opportunities to grow within and not have to leave and become principals, but within
right.
the profession of teaching, take on more responsibility, become
mm-hmm.
mentors, become perhaps evaluators of their peers, become leaders of professional development within their schools. Those type of opportunities are included in this as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for
yes.
joining us today. We've been speaking with Rachel Langford of the Portland Director of Stanford Children, and Mike Rosen, who is a parent volunteer. Please note their upcoming events at the Kennedy School, and you mentioned...
So there's one on the 15th. That's an introductory meeting, an introductory basically training for Stanford Children on the 15th, 6:30 to 8 at Westminster Presbyterian Church. And then on the 18th at the Kennedy School in the community room, a workshop on revenue with some local elected officials and with Steve Novick.
And be sure to visit their website, which is stand.org. And find a way to spread the efforts of Stanford Children throughout the state and in your community. What's coming up next?
Coming up next is the OMO Variety Hour. Topics include the racial and class politics of city planning in Portland. Who gets to do the planning and how are neighborhoods affected? At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, the guest on If You Love This Planet is Jeff Cohen, media critic and commentator. He described the media environment at the beginning of the current Iraq conflict and explains how independent journalists and bloggers have become major players in today's multimedia landscape. And at 11, Jinka Soderberg speaks with John Hurston, who just returned from Gaza, where he participated in a convoy of trucks attempting to bring humanitarian aid to the region.
That's what we have. Stay tuned to find out what goes beyond. This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. This has been More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott, myself, Celeste Carey. And we hope you stay tuned to KBOO as we accompany you with news and information you can use throughout your day. Goodbye.
Monday, this is your community calendar for the 30th of March, 2009. The Portland Restaurant Workers Association is a community group made up of workers committed to promoting solidarity, support, and education among food service workers in our city. This evening at 7, the association will host a forum on the top 5 wage and hour violations in restaurants and how to protect your rights on the job. All are welcome to attend. Also this evening at 7, you are invited to a screening of the documentary Arid Lands. This internationally acclaimed film is about the land and people of the Columbia River Basin and the aftermath of environmental contamination and cleanup at the Hanford nuclear site. The screening will take place at First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th and Main in downtown Portland. Tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday, March 31st, the Portland State University chapters of Mecha and Las Mujeres invite you to join a demonstration and march honoring the legacy of Cesar Chavez, legendary workers' rights champion and co-founder of the United Farm Workers. The demonstration will address ongoing campaigns for comprehensive immigration reform and workers' rights in the state of Oregon and nationwide. The group will gather up at noon at Portland State University's park blocks on the corner of Park Avenue and Harrison Street, and the march will commence soon after. Portland Hearing Voices is a new community learning partnership dedicated to education around hearing voices, unusual sensory experiences, and mental diversity. Tomorrow evening, Tuesday the 31st, Hearing Voices invites you to a documentary film screening and discussion presenting different points of view on these little understood phenomena. This event is wheelchair accessible and open to the public, and it will take place at 6 p.m. in the meeting room of the Multnomah County Public Library's downtown branch, located at 801 Southwest 10th Avenue at Yamhill. For more information about any of the events mentioned on the calendar, call the KBOO front desk at 503-231-8032 or check out the listings at kboo.fm/community calendar. And you have just heard the KBOO community calendar on 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, and 91.9 FM Columbia Gorge.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Peaceworks, presenting the 25th annual Give Peace a Dance benefit concert and auction, Saturday, April 11th, 6 p.m. at the Grand Ballroom in downtown Salem, with music by Linda Hornbuckle, Kate Sullivan, Jenna Summer-Smith, and political satire by Dr. Atomic's Medicine Show. Appetizers and desserts included, silent and oral auctions, and bar. Tickets at 503-585-2767 or OregonPeaceWorks.org.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Steve is our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative solutions to social and political problems that fall outside the capitalist paradigm of our elected officials, the Obama administration, though progressive in some ways, being no exception. Bill Resnick will lead off today's program interviewing Leo Panitch. They'll be talking about this very subject, the severe problems capitalism currently faces, the limitations of Obama's response, and possible openings this leaves for the left. Leo Panitch is a Marxist professor of political science at York University in Toronto, Ontario, and editor of the Socialist Register. If you follow pop culture at all, you are aware of the singer Rihanna being physically assaulted by her musician boyfriend, Chris Brown. Fran Michelle is here to discuss that sort of event and the problem of dating violence in general. I'll be giving a eulogy for Archie Green, a well-known union activist and folklorist who died a week ago Sunday in San Francisco. Rounding out today's program, Laurie Mercier will be talking with George Lizarraga, who is a diversity faculty fellow at WSU Vancouver on loan from UC Berkeley, and is finishing a study on the impact of urban design theories and city planning policies on the racial and ethnic demography of Portland. But right now, here's Bill talking with Leo Panitch.
Thanks, Tom. Leo Panitch, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill.
Leo Panitch is a Canadian, writes and teaches about the U.S. and global system. He's a really big thinker, a sober thinker, but sees visionary possibilities. Leo Panitch, Barack Obama has been reading history about Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Obama and the administration apparently see themselves as having to save the union and the capitalist system, too. Is this just political posturing, political positioning? How do you see the current crisis and the Obama administration's efforts so far?
Well, I think they are cast in the role that Roosevelt was to some extent in the 1930s, that is, of saving capitalism. And although Roosevelt, by 1936, was being called a socialist and even worse, a communist, by many people in business, many people on Wall Street, he explicitly was oriented to saving capitalism and made no bones about that. And Obama is in much the same situation in what is the most severe economic crisis since the 1930s. The difference may be that it now looks like Roosevelt was rather more prepared to step on capitalist toes than Obama is. Yet he was prepared, for reasons we could talk about, or was pushed at any rate in the 1930s, to do things that he thought were necessary to save capitalism that the capitalists with a much narrower perspective didn't like. Obama doesn't seem to be capable of asserting, either on his own or because of the people he surrounded himself with, asserting that degree of independence from the capitalist class in the United States.
You're referring then to the crisis in finance and the banking system and the absolute need to restructure it, yet he seems to be relying on a lot of the same old guys who have kept their positions and their bonuses.
Yes, and he seems very frightened that to do anything that might undermine their confidence further. So even though the banking system is completely dysfunctional, even though we can see that it serves a completely social purpose and that the whole economy is dependent on it, but nevertheless is held in private hands, in the hands really of very few people, he doesn't seem ready or capable of going beyond that to turn the financial system into a public utility. The result of that is that both the American economy and really the world economy is frozen by virtue of the fact that private bank lending is frozen and is just not profitable for bankers, and they see it as too dangerous for them to be engaging in lending. And the stimulus program, no matter how rich, won't have the kind of effect that people hope it will have unless it is multiplied by lending through the banking system.
What is the alternative to Obama's reliance on and really pleading with the bankers to begin lending again, which they aren't doing for actually good banking reasons?
That's right.
You really don't know the
value of the assets they're holding.
Right, and the whether these companies or people or whoever you're lending to will survive the downturn.
That's right, and they're even afraid, let alone subprime mortgages and all of the derivatives built on them, they're increasingly afraid that the corporate bonds that they hold will be defaulted on, or the third world private or public bonds that they're holding will be defaulted on as trade collapses, as profits in the third world collapse, and so on. In that context, he is a prisoner of the reluctance of the banking system, having, you know, led us into this mess, to now get us out of it. The alternative would be to indeed nationalize the whole banking system. Now, most people on the left in the United States then say, nationalize it, eat up the bad debt, and then sell it back after the public sector has eaten up the bad debt, has socialized the debt, as one can say,
give it back to the private bankers. That's what was done in Japan in the late 90s and Sweden in the early 90s. But in fact, that is a extremely undemocratic way to go. And what I would say this provides us with an opportunity with is to finally take this crucial element of our society into the democratic domain, into the public domain, and change the criteria upon which banking and really the decisions about what's to be invested, where it's to be invested, how it's to be invested, to finally take those decisions into the democratic public arena.
It's going to be a long time, though, before it seems to me the administration, they're going to have to be driven into it, and the American people are going to take your advice. It's not inconceivable, though, that they will be driven into it if the crisis keeps deepening and if the population gets more desperate and worried. How do you see operating? I mean, it's important to talk about that right now, the necessity of it, and also the great potentials of it. How do we do that?
Well, it's not going to happen without tremendous pressure from below for it to happen. And that can come from a very, very wide variety of sources, from, the workers who are not only being laid off but are being forced to reopen their contracts with the auto companies, even while the managers in the banks and the insurance companies hold on to their million-dollar bonuses on the grounds that they have contracts. But it doesn't only apply to working people who see the hypocrisy and the essential class nature of that. It also applies to small businessmen. It applies to professionals. It applies to people very broadly in the middle class who increasingly in this crisis can come to see how dependent they are on the decisions of a small group of private bankers. But it would need a tremendous amount of pressure from below. And what Roosevelt did that was really reformist during the New Deal, and it did make a difference to people's lives, was done under that kind of pressure. It was done under the mobilizations of the unemployed, the enormous mass mobilizations of people in the labor sector, which led to the great unionization reforms of the 1930s and so on. There was also a radicalization in the universities and in the media, which pushed all of this. Some of those people found their way with these radical ideas into the Roosevelt administration. But it was pressure from the outside as much as from the in, really more from the in, that pushed him in this direction. Mm-hmm. Now, Obama has called for people to put pressure on him. And one would hope that those people who were so active through the Internet and in door-to-door campaigns would be putting pressure on him now after the election. We'll have to see the extent to which that happens.
Yeah, I wonder if that call for pressure, even if very sincere, and I suspect it may well be, it doesn't in fact take some of the pressure off, because those people who would have to be applying the pressure are hearing from him that somehow he's on their side. I'm working for you. Please. We'd almost be better off putting pressure on George W. Bush, at least in the United States now.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point.
And then 3.4 million people last week were on the streets in France protesting and challenging the government and frightening them to death.
Yeah.
It's not happening in the United States.
I think that's a very good point. But that also has to do, of course, with the decrepit nature of the American labor movement and the lack of organizational coherence of the American left. The French are capable of pulling off these one-day general strikes, and this one was bigger than usual given the context of the crisis. Nevertheless, they're capable of pulling these off because the left is far better organized, both in the labor movement and more generally in politics, than the North American left is in general. And what this is going to require is a transformation of the nature of trade unionism in the United States, some of which there are signs of it taking place in certain sectors, not least in California and out on the West Coast generally, but also via new political organizations. And there again, you could say, the hope that's been invested in a resurgence of the Democratic Party as a spokesman for working people and so on may delay that. On the other hand, it's to be hoped, and this was the case in the 60s, that as with the Kennedy-Johnson years, that this will give a fillip to movements and to political organization and political radicalism rather than be a damper on it. And that's what did happen in the 60s.
Leo Panitch, this is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Leo Panitch. He's done many wonderful books, lots of essays, one called The Globalization Decade, a book. A second, Renewing Socialism, Democracy, Strategy, and the Imagination. We've been talking about the economic crisis, the Obama administration's efforts that so far have been probably not commensurate with the degree of the problem. Leo Panitch, and also talking about the possibilities of big movements in the United States. Leo Panitch, your assessment of sort of the U.S. left and the labor movement, seeing them both as quite anemic and disorganized and unable to actually lead the kind of struggles that would be necessary. That implies, though, there's still something there, clearly, and but it implies that it's going to take a while, and it may well be that we're going to have some time because this crisis is likely to get worse, although one can never tell. Soothsaying is not our strong suit, but it does look very serious, and they're not going to be able to reconstitute in the old way. Am I right about that? It seems the financial bubble that kept the economy going for various bubbles for 25 years are not going to be reconstituted. Do you see that sort of long-term, it's going to be a long-term struggle that in fact, progressives can work in?
Yes, I think it is. I think that we have time, if you want to put it that way.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes, that's right. I mean, a lot of people are going to suffer as a result. Yes, I see this as a very, very serious crisis. And one that is going to last and that there's no easy way out of. And it is necessary, as you're implying, that people have patience in that context. And that they do come up with short-term reforms, immediate reforms, as well as generate a long-term vision. And be open about the inadequacy of the short-term reforms. So, for instance, Bernie Sanders just last week called for a cap on interest rates on credit cards. And what we indeed are seeing is that the extent to which the American economy depended on working people, middle class people, living on credit in a context where their incomes had been constrained for so long since the 1970s. They were able to keep up their standard of living through credit. And they now are in a situation where although the interest that banks are paying if you put $5 into an account is practically zero, they're charging people 20, 30, 40, 50% on their credit cards as people can't afford to pay off the minimum debt. And Sanders has introduced a piece of legislation in the Congress that would put a 15% cap on these usurious payments. And that's good. That's a good thing. But it also speaks to the enormous inequity of that reform, that what is considered to be a good thing is that people should be paying 15% interest to the very banks that themselves are giving practically no interest as to money put into the banking system. So they're making a profit, if you like, of 15 times what they're paying out. That should show the necessity of the reform and the inadequacy of it. And it ought to, people ought to struggle for that reform and then struggle for far, far more radical alternatives of the kind I was speaking of in terms of banking being a public utility. Those things are possible to combine in a political mobilization. And hopefully that is what is going to happen. You can see that across the board. In those areas where you're seeing a collapsing industrial sector, let's take the auto sector, it is necessary to secure the kind of supports to keep plants in operation that are essential to their communities. But at the same time, it's necessary to be calling for, in the auto sector, for instance, the taking of that whole auto sector into the public arena. If you like, the nationalization of the auto companies and the parts companies, and their conversion into the production of things that people are really going to need, which is not private cars run on oil, on gasoline, on a fossil economy, if you like, but rather modes of transportation that are energy efficient, whether it's hydrogen or electricity. But more than that, the conversion of that industry into the production of things like solar panels to produce cheap solar energy, which is going to have to come in the next generation and can come with enough investment in technological change.
Yeah. Even in fact, if the government now, is not ready, in fact, to basically nationalize, although they have in some ways, and just sacked the president of GM today. But if they're not willing to nationalize, and in fact are probably going to be trying to move GM towards clean cars and somewhat new energy system, rather than in fact really converting into a very different kind of energy system and doing wind turbines and many other sort of necessary infrastructure elements, if they're not ready to do that now, they may well be in 2 or 3 years if we, in fact, keep maintaining the pressure and build that vision. I gather that's your the way you see it.
It's perhaps a bit more optimistic than I am about where they'll be 2-3 years from now.
Or 5 years or 8 years. And it seems to me all of American life now, the health system, the justice system, the energy system, there's nothing that isn't in contest now in certainly the financial system, as you discussed.
Yeah.
Everything now is being questioned and in contest. It's really an enormous, to quote Rahm Emanuel, I know you agree with that, a really deep crisis is a terrible thing to waste. We can put a left vision on the agenda now for the first time in a long time.
I entirely agree with that. And I would say something else about American political culture. There is a tendency on the part of the intellectual American left, at least, and the labor leadership, to think that what the United States has missed has been the Canadian or European type of labor or social democratic party. And it's my feeling, and I felt it for a long time, that that's mistaken, that those types of social democratic and labor parties are extremely hidebound, afraid of their own shadow, very much themselves caught within the limits of the system. And there may be something quite liberating to the fact that the United States doesn't have that heavy tradition. And it may very well be possible that the American left could blow past European social democracy to something that is more democratic, that builds in a positive way on the populist and progressive tradition in the United States. And it would be a mistake, I think, although I think this is going to be most common, partly because at least of the public health care debate,
right,
which social democracy gave us and not
Leo, I'm afraid we're going to have to, I'm getting the signal that that we have to end.
Well, as we said, we've got lots of time.
We have time, and people are actually enthused. There is a vision. Thanks a lot for talking to us
Good
today.
Good to talk to you, Bill.
Right. So long.
Bye. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Dating violence is back in the news again with the recent assault by musician Chris Brown on his singer girlfriend Rihanna. Fran Michelle is here to discuss this perennial problem that only seems to get much public attention when the rich and famous are involved.
If there's one good thing about the publicity surrounding pop singer Chris Brown's arrest on felony assault charges for an incident that left pop singer Rihanna with visible injuries, it's that it's raised awareness about violence in intimate relationships, and especially dating violence among young people. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, each year in the U.S., about 4.8 million women and 2.9 million men are physically assaulted by an intimate partner. The gender disparity increases with the level of violence. Of those killed by an intimate partner, three-quarters are women. Similarly, for teens, 1 in 11 adolescents reports being a victim of physical dating violence, and 1 in 5 high school girls has been physically or sexually abused by a dating partner. This sort of information has been much more widely disseminated in recent weeks. Even the New York Times has written about the issue, reporting that nearly 10% of teenagers report being hit or slapped by a boyfriend or girlfriend, and quoting Dr. Elizabeth Miller of the University of California Davis School of Medicine, who states that the numbers of girls who sustain serious injuries and the sexual violence sustained against girls is much higher than for boys. But there may be such a thing as bad publicity, and I say that not just because the Times put the story in their fashion and style section, and not even just because the release of the battered woman's name and photo was a breach of her privacy. I say it because, as the staff at Alternet also note, most of the dialogue surrounding the incident hasn't done much to advance an intelligent, empathetic discussion about the problem. In addition to the initial statements of support for Brown, there's been a good deal of blame and criticism of Rihanna, especially following reports that she's continued her relationship with him. Given the nature of public discourse on this subject, we shouldn't be that surprised by the results of a widely reported survey of 200 teenagers by the Boston Public Health Commission, in which 46% said Rihanna was responsible for what happened, despite knowing that her injuries required hospital treatment. A post by Jill on the blog Feminist explains the response of girls in the survey by comparing it to self-defensive victim blaming in sexual assault cases. If you can pin the responsibility for the violence on something the woman did, you can live without the fear that someone might harm you in a similar way. If you convince yourself that women get raped because they go somewhere they shouldn't, or because they dress in a particular way, or because they drink too much, or because they have a bad reputation, then it's easy enough to convince yourself that if you just act right, you'll be safe. If you convince yourself that women get beaten because they talk back or because they instigate the violence with physical aggression or because they otherwise bring violence upon themselves, then it's easy enough to convince yourself that you won't ever end up getting beaten. End quote. Andy Wright on Alternet critiques those who said that in continuing the relationship, Rihanna is condoning the behavior of abusive partners. But, he writes, Rihanna's treatment at the hands of the press will be more damaging to domestic abuse victims than her behavior ever could be. Casting Rihanna as the willing victim and summarily revoking sympathy as a means of punishing her for a perceived complacency sends a clear message that women who are victims of abuse deserve compassion on a conditional basis only. Victims should speak out, but only if they are ready to leave their partner and, better still, engage in legal retaliation. This, of course, ignores the fact that many women suffer the same kind of re-victimization in court that Rihanna is currently suffering at the hands of the press. If victims of domestic violence are taking any message away from this fracas, it's that once other people become aware of your situation, you open yourself up to criticism and contempt. End quote. But even the Alternet writers, who are clearly trying to advance an intelligent and empathetic discussion of the problem, shy away from addressing the politics of the problem of domestic violence. While Wright's argument hints that legal retaliation might not be the only or best response, he stops short of addressing those limitations more explicitly. In an essay in the collection Nobody Passes, Priya Kandaswamy points out that The success of the battered women's movement has proven to be a double-edged sword. In order to gain public support, domestic violence advocates portrayed abused women as innocent victims who suffered at the hands of particularly deviant men. While this narrative perhaps sought to combat the idea that abuse was a woman's fault, it drew upon dominant ideas of innocence and victimhood and required that women represent themselves in particular ways in order to be recognized as deserving of assistance. This requirement to pass as a good victim reinforced dominant gender norms and also marginalized women of color, immigrant women, working class women, homeless women, lesbians, gay men, transgender people, and anyone who did not or could not fit these norms. Perhaps even more insidiously, these kinds of legislative engagements with the state have increasingly come to pass as the only kind of real or acceptable politics. Under the rubric of helping real victims of real crimes, approaches that emphasize criminalization and rehabilitation have usurped critiques that sought to change how power is distributed in society and have naturalized the process of criminalizing violence against women and seeking expanded state funding for services for battered women as the only available political approaches to the problem. End quote. As the Alternate staff note, it's now more important than ever to shed light on domestic violence because the economic meltdown is likely to drive up the incidence of abuse. The National Domestic Abuse Hotline documented a 21% increase in calls for September 2008 over the same month in 2007. And although research shows that recession and unemployment don't cause spousal abuse by themselves, they do exacerbate situations where violence is already a factor. But some activists and progressives are looking for other ways to address problems of intimate violence. Portland's Dicentra Collective, for instance, on which KABU has reported here on The Old Mole, as well as on Circle A and Positively Revolting Talk Radio, has been working on harm reduction approaches to intimate violence and creating safer spaces. Those interested in reducing family violence may also want to take note of next month's event on child abuse prevention, offered by Listen to Kids, and in other words, Women's Books and Resources. Rather than imagining that abuse is only real when it happens to a suitably innocent victim at the hands of a particularly deviant man, we need to continue seeking not only to reduce violence, but also to change how power is distributed in society. For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michelle.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late, if they come at all. Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all. And when they arrive, they say they can't interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes. Last night I heard the screaming, then a silence that chilled my soul. Afraid that I was dreaming when I saw the ambulance in the road. And the policeman said, I'm here to keep the peace. Will the crowd disperse? I think we all could use some sleep. Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all.
That was Tracy Chapman, Behind the Wall, her protest against domestic violence. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU, 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Archie Greene, a name even many people on the left are probably not familiar with, was America's most prominent scholar of labor-related folklore. Archie, as he's universally known, was a scholar of what he called labor lore, the expressive culture of working people. For 5 decades, he studied hillbilly music and pile drivers' tales and the culture of working people. He made inventories of tin men, the showpieces of sheet metal workers, and analyzed sailors' slang. He recorded songs by mill workers and miners' wives. Working on until just months before his death, he wrote countless articles, both academic and popular, and 5 books, including Only a Miner, his landmark study of coal mining music. Last weekend, Green, often called the grandfather of labor history, passed away in his San Francisco home at the age of 91. Archie Green was a shipwright turned folklorist, whose interest in union workers and their culture transformed the study of American folklore. Green drew on a childhood enthusiasm for cowboy songs and a devotion to the union movement to conduct a singular academic career. Returning to college at age 40, he began studying what he called labor lore, the work songs, slang, craft techniques, and tales that helped to define the trade unions and create a sense of group identity. At the same time, Mr. Green energetically promoted the idea of public folklore. That is, the folklorists should work outside the academy to gather, preserve, and publicize local cultures through government agencies, museums, folk festivals, and radio stations. His signal achievement in this area was the lonely lobbying campaign he conducted for nearly 6 years to create a National Folklife Center, which became a reality when Congress, by unanimous vote, passed the American Folklife Preservation Act, signed into law by President Ford in January 1976. Mr. Green was born Aaron Green in Winnipeg, Manitoba. His father had fled Cherganov in present-day Ukraine after taking part in the failed 1905 Russian Revolution. When he was a small boy, the family moved to Los Angeles, where he listened to cowboy songs on the radio, absorbed socialist politics from his father, and developed a passionate dedication to the labor union movement and the New Deal. After earning a degree in political science from the University of California, Berkeley, Mr. Green decided to throw in his lot with the working class. He joined the Civilian Conservation Corps, working as a road builder and firefighter along the Klamath River, and became a shipwright and union activist on the San Francisco waterfront. For the rest of his life, he identified himself first and foremost as a worker and a union member. After serving as a Navy Seabee during World War II, Mr. Green returned to the waterfront, but later switched to carpentry. As the union movement lost some of its energy, he went back to academia, enrolling at the University of Illinois to become a labor historian. There, as an advisor to the campus folk music club, he sent students out into the field to record the indigenous music of central and southern Illinois and wrote a seminal article, Hillbilly Music, Source and Symbol. He went on to earn a doctorate in folklore at the University of Pennsylvania. His dissertation on the songs of Kentucky coal miners was published in 1972 as Only a Miner. His approach to occupational folklore was not far short of revolutionary. It has been said that before Archie, the field did not have a clear vision of what occupational folklore was. There was a huge disconnect between academics, who took a literary, almost 19th century view of what folklore was, and someone like Archie, who wanted to tell the pile driver or the auto worker, you have your own culture that is unique, that no other occupation has. Green's most recent publication is the Big Red Songbook, featuring the lyrics to the 190 songs included in the various editions of the Little Red Songbooks from 1909 to 1973 by the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies. Green inherited this project from John Newhouse, a machinist and IWW member who devoted years to collecting a nearly complete set of the IWW songbooks and determining what music the songs had been set to. When Newhouse died of cancer in 1958, he gave his unique collection of songbooks, sheet music, and other materials to Green, who vowed to carry on Newhouse's vision of a complete edition of the IWW songs. In his final months, Mr. Green continued to organize and agitate, issuing directives from his deathbed to colleagues and friends. His pet project was to convince Congress that it should, as in the days of the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration, set aside money for artists, filmmakers, photographers, writers, and yes, folklorists, to document the projects put into motion by the stimulus bill. This piece has been called principally from his obituary in Sunday's New York Times, as well as various websites. If you want to learn more about Archie Green, simply do a web search for his name. Now, what could be more appropriate than to play a song from the Little Red Songbook? This is The Preacher and the Slave by by Michael Hurley.
Lonely preachers come out every night. They will tell you what's wrong and what's right. Do you ask them for something to eat? They'll tell you with voices so sweet.
Closing out our program today, Laura Mercier is here in the studio with Jorge Lizarraga, an urban planning specialist from UC Berkeley, currently completing a study at WSU Vancouver on the demographic impact of urban planning theories and city planning policies on the ethnic and racial makeup of Portland.
Thanks, Tom. Jorge Lizarraga is a human geographer and currently diversity faculty fellow at WSU Vancouver. And before moving to the Pacific Northwest, Jorge was on the Geography and Ethnic Studies faculty at California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo. And as Tom mentioned, he's finishing his PhD in geography at the University of California, Berkeley, focusing on the influence of urban design theories and city planning policies on the racial geography of Portland. Welcome to KABU, Jorge.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jorge, last month, Mayor Sam Adams led the City Council in a 4-1 vote approving the biggest, most car-friendly option to widen the I-5 bridges spanning the Columbia River to Vancouver, Washington, 12 lanes. The Columbia River Crossing is the biggest public works project in our region's history, and it's projected to cost a whopping $4 billion. A number of community groups have protested the environmental and health costs of the plan, including the Coalition for a Livable Future, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and the Environmental Justice Action Group, but their voices have largely been excluded and overpowered by the steamroller of development. And in fact, the mayor and council refused to support Commissioner Amanda Fritz's modest green amendment to the Big Bridge proposal to include environmental justice advocates on a new bridge management committee. And Jorge, as you have found in your research, there's a long history of excluding low-income voices and neighborhoods in planning and designing public projects in Portland. So tell us about who won and who lost in some earlier projects that most of us have probably long associated with the built environment in Portland, but know little about the origins.
Well, city of Portland today, of course, is known as a standout example of what's supposed to be good planning, policy, and execution. And to be sure, the city of Portland has had some amazing successes revitalizing its downtown, its mass transit system, that are absolutely worthy of praising and recognizing. But this latest type of planning is, of course, just the latest in urban planning policy the city has had from almost its the beginning of the 20th century. And at different times, like with any kind of important policy, there are unforeseen consequences. In terms of urban planning in particular, the first serious ideas of what Portland ought to look like as designed by urban planners really come at the turn of the century. And at that time, the city was undergoing economic growth, but it was also facing some social and economic movements that were also impacting other urban areas. But essentially, it was an idea of trying to shape the city to face a growing economic complexity, sort of competing social movements, and so on. And throughout the period, the economic imperatives of real estate development, industry, and so on, came first and foremost. They were going to be paying for the different implementations of the plans. Businessmen in those days, there was no city planning department as such. Economic leaders actually would hire outside consultants to come up with possible plans. And in Portland, that meant hiring the best, and that meant essentially hiring folks who were behind the City Beautiful movement and so on.
Mm-hmm. And then later, with in the post-war period, post-World War II, federal money became available for cities in their development projects. So tell us about one of the first big development projects.
Well, with the Great Depression and World War II in particular, a growing role for federal monies in local and regional and state government, of course, became available. And these were especially true when it came to local planning projects. And by the end of the war, as the war was winding down, people were trying to imagine what America would look like in the aftermath of the war, particularly how the cities would be shaped. People wondered if some cities might actually be abandoned because of the rapid loss of wartime jobs and so on. So there was this interesting interest in urban planning and renewal for the cities after the war. And Portland was no different. By the 1950s, Portland was examining a variety of different options. They had had several sort of homegrown ideas on planning, but began to implement them through the 1950s.
And you have written about the South Auditorium Project, which is one of these first big projects to actually demolish neighborhoods.
Well, that's right. The South Auditorium Project was Portland's first large-scale redevelopment project. And it's actually a project that changed much of Portland, and most people take the landscape that it created for granted. It essentially affected the areas from Clay heading towards the Ross Island Bridge and adjacent to Portland State University, up to basically the riverfront. And that had been, up until the 1950s, one of Portland's more important ethnic neighborhoods. It was strongly Italian-American and Jewish. The famed painter Mark Rothko grew up in that area. He went to Lincoln High School before moving to New York and carry on his painting career. But it was a thriving community. But in the 1950s, it was slated for redevelopment, which meant two things, really. First, the urban redevelopment of the neighborhood itself, but also clearing of the neighborhood for the interstate projects that were coming through, including Interstate 5 and especially 405 later. These were two actually different federal government programs, but they worked hand-in-hand, a federal government transportation program and the redevelopment urban funding that was coming through.
And how did those neighborhoods react to those proposals? Did they have any voice in where those freeway plans were directed and so on?
Well, through the 1950s, large-scale urban planning policies and politics mirrored what was happening in the rest of the country. It was a time period where the federal government was quite strong. People believed in essentially a top-down planning and other federal type approach to government policy. And it was essentially the old notion of the greatest good for the greatest numbers. And there really, quite frankly, wasn't too much attention paid to the well-being of the residents. Some folks were pushed out, depending on the particular federal program, with some monies to relocate. Others had to vacate altogether. In fact, it was kind of the treatment of these kinds of neighborhoods, not just in Portland, but in New York, in Chicago, in Boston, and so on, that started a reaction against the large redevelopment projects, including here in Portland. People were beginning to grasp the ideas and accept the ideas of people like Lewis Mumford and, of course, Jane Jacobs. And with the political activism, particularly coming from the neighborhoods in the 1960s, people began to question these large-scale projects, beginning first with large-scale transportation and interstate projects, and then on through the neighborhood redevelopment projects.
And then Neil Goldschmidt is one of these who's mobilizing people against some of these projects, such as the Mount Hood freeway that was planned to bisect much of southeast Portland.
That's right. In fact, throughout the country, the Mount Hood freeway is considered one of the early important successes in stopping a large-scale project. There had been others in Boston, in San Francisco. Mayor Arliotto had stopped the Embarcadero freeway and so on. And Goldschmidt, first as a neighborhood activist and then on the city council, and of course as mayor, effectively ended that project. The concern, of course, was that the freeway was going to displace thousands of residents, was going to divide up the city, and that essentially neighborhood folks hadn't been consulted on these projects that were going to affect so much of their lives. And so it proved an effective strategy to stop the freeway, and you began to get a new kind of urban planning that emphasized participation by local folks. And as mayor, of course, Goldschmidt is known for a new type of urban planning.
But as you find that some groups were more successful than others in having a voice in that planning, and there were some other projects that actually wiped out entire neighborhoods in northeast Portland, including the plan for Legacy Hospital and so on.
Well, that's correct. Even before Neil Goldschmidt had become mayor, and even been on the city council, there were already clearance projects in northeast Portland. The clearance for the Memorial Stadium, for example, and what would become the Rose Quarter, was underway in the early 60s. That was part of the legacy of those top-down type of projects from before. The massive clearance of northeast Portland for the construction of I-5, and related to that was the building and development of the convention center area and especially the Lloyd Center. All these impacted the most concentrated area of the city with African Americans. It was essentially the community for African Americans in the Portland area. It was a vital economic and cultural area. And so all that was underway before Goldschmidt became mayor. And there were effective plans put in to continue the leveling for expansion of the Emanuel Legacy Hospital. Goldschmidt didn't draw up those plans necessarily, but they were carried out under his administration. And so ironically, while Goldschmidt came to power effectively fighting the clearing of neighborhoods and putting a stop to large-scale projects that would do that, under his administration, the area around Williams and Russell got cleared out, as many blocks did, in anticipation of federal monies that wound up not coming and left the area devastated. It wiped out the core of what was left of the African American business district in that particular neighborhood, and of course displaced many residents as well.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, and I'm speaking with Jorge Lizarraga about the history of city planning policies on the racial geography of Portland. And Jorge, just in light of that kind of devastation that was inflicted upon the African-American neighborhoods of Northeast Portland, I mean, what does this say about the process of planning and where individuals such as Neil Goldschmidt might have had sympathies with neighborhood groups, this whole structure of the economy and federal money coming into an area tends to almost act like a steamroller, I used that metaphor earlier, in pushing out critical voices.
Well, that's one of the contradictions of the kinds of planning policies Portland has had. On the one hand, you had Goldschmidt promoting a progressive agenda, doing some amazing things to stop the freeway construction, to expand mass transit for the city. He became well known for that, of course. He appointed people from the community in his position, pushed community activism involvement in the planning policy. But at the end of the day, the imperatives of local developers and interests sort of still won out, in that the Emmanuel clearance continued on, and of course just the market forces that would lead to Portland to be successful in some of these material things led to a revitalization of the housing markets and so on, that led to, of course, an accelerated gentrification of the Northeast, which, of course, we're seeing since the 90s, pushing even more African-American residents out of the area.
And as you said, the imperatives of capital tend to force actions in certain directions.
That's right. I mean, urban planning as a profession has a lot to celebrate in terms of how it's able to change direction, come up with new ideas, fascinating approaches, and so on. On the other hand, they're also not necessarily the leaders in urban development. They're usually coming in to fulfill some interests or planning need that's really set by folks outside of the planning profession. And politicians are in that mix as much as anyone else is.
We have just another minute, Jorge, but are there any stories that you can, or examples from Portland's history where you could just sort of quickly tell us how people have successfully mobilized to shape the planning process?
Well,
lessons that might help guide activists today.
Well, actually, Portland has one of the best examples of any city I know of where people early on put a stop to it. At the height of this sort of top-down planning, Northwest Portland was slated to be actually Portland's first redevelopment project, the Vaughan Street Project. And local activists there, essentially a working class community, came together and with coalition politics put a stop to what was supposed to be that first clearance. Essentially all of Northwest Portland along 23rd Street and at Vaughan was essentially going to be cleared out and changed completely from what it looks like today. And that successful resistance allowed that vital community not only to survive and eventually thrive the way it has today, but it's a great model that other folks might want to look into a little more and see how we can come together and challenge these things.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Jorge Lizarraga. And this is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, thank you, Laurie and Jorge. That completes our program for today. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Steve has been our engineer. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. And don't forget, this program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can find links to more information about guests and topics on the web pages for the show. Now stay tuned at 10 for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and William Delta.
At 10:15, the guest on If You Love This Planet is Jeff Cohen, media critic and commentator. He describes the media environment at the beginning of the current Iraq conflict and explains how independent journalists and bloggers have become major players in today's multimedia landscape. At 11, Jenka Soderberg speaks with John Herson, who has just returned from Gaza, where he participated in a convoy of trucks attempting to bring humanitarian aid to the region.